Welcome to Hold My Reg, a Quill and Sword podcast brought to you by the Administrative and Civil Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Administrative law may not always make the headlines, but it is the invisible force that maintains discipline, ensures fairness, and ultimately keeps our military running smoothly. Get ready for another insightful discussion, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Hold My Reg. I am Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kinslow, here along with my co-host, Major Curtis Cranston. Say hi to the folks, Major Cranston.
Hi, folks.
And we are super excited to have with us Lieutenant Colonel Jenna Farrell from the Army's Environmental Law Division. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, Colonel Farrell.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Major Cranston and I are either current or, in my case, past environmental law professors here at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. So we're both pretty familiar with the Army's environmental program. However, I do think in our larger corps, we're in the minority, as our uniformed JAG Corps teammates seldom get much direct involvement with environmental law. For that reason, we hope that this episode will provide a helpful introduction. So, all that said, I'd like to start by focusing everyone to the operational environment. Then we can transition more specifically to Environmental Law Division's part in that. Colonel Farrell, what would you say are the primary environmental issues facing the Army today?
That is a difficult question to answer just because of the broad scope and impact that environmental law issues have on almost every aspect of Army operations. But I'll try to narrow it down a little bit for you, and then we'll talk more about what ELD does. Those issues tend to encompass air and water quality, wetlands preservation, endangered species, wildlife habitat, solid and hazardous waste treatment storage and transportation, cleanup of hazardous materials, and land usage and controls, just to name a few. I'd say if I had to name the top three most significant issues that the Army is facing today, they'd include the following: retention and expansion of our training areas and ranges. That is probably number one on the list, and that's why I put it there. There's a very good reason for that. The legal mechanisms for those functions include withdrawal of lands from public use and appropriation, land exchange, lease renewals, even condemnation and purchase through eminent domain, all of which are processes that require environmental review, mostly through the National Environmental Policy Act processes, or NEPA. Some examples of where that's happening right now include Fort Wainwright, where we're looking at a renewal of a withdrawal of 658,000 acres, Fort Bliss, where there are 608,000 acres at issue, Fort Irwin, 117,000 acres, and most notably, perhaps, in Hawaii, where we're looking at the renewal of leases for training land that's owned by the state of Hawaii. Also, Pinyon Canyon near Fort Carson, we're trying to expand the use of that area for large unit training, mainly the SBCTs and the ABCT out there. I'd say number two on the list is the preservation and obtaining of critical water rights that facilitate our training and mission accomplishment. A couple of installations where those issues are at the top of the priority list include Fort Carson and Fort Huachuca. And then finally, we also are in a constant battle to defend against liability claims related to third-party legacy cleanup sites, resulting mostly from World War II and Cold War era sites that were contaminated with a variety of chemicals. But the reason I mention it in the top priorities is because we also anticipate defending additional cases, or at least reopening old cases, due to what's called PFAS contamination. And I could talk about PFAS for a very long time, but needless to say, to try to boil it down to the bottom line, PFAS are a group of what we often refer to as forever chemicals. They're ubiquitous in that they don't break down well in the environment. And they're found in the aqueous film-forming foam that our firefighters use to extinguish dangerous fires on installations. They're also found in hundreds of consumer products, like certain kinds of cookware, personal care items, and cleaning items and food packaging. Pretty much found everywhere, and are increasingly known to present some issues to human health. And so we are making that a top priority within the Army to look at what we can do to address and potentially clean up those chemicals as they're found in our environment.
Ma'am, in light of that huge range of issues that you face, What are some of the most significant environmental laws and regulations affecting Army operations? You mentioned NEPA as one.
Absolutely. And I'd put that one at the top of the list, given how it tends to intercept or inject itself into many of our cases, be it on the compliance side where we're trying to prevent litigation, or on the litigation side where we have reached the point at which compliance and enforcement have not perhaps worked or been successful, and we're now facing some sort of a claim against us. It's often referred to as a bit of an alphabet soup when we talk about environmental federal statutes, and they're both procedural and substantive in nature. Again, that one that you just mentioned, NEPA, that plays into almost all of the work that we're doing right now on the compliance and the litigation sides. The National Historic Preservation Act, NHPA, is another big one. The Endangered Species Act, ESA, that plays into a couple of our cases on the litigation side that I'll describe a little bit later as well. The Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, NAGPRA, that's an active has an active role in one of our cases that is going through the federal court system right now. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act. CERCLA is our cleanup statute, also known as the Superfund Act. It stands for Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act. And finally, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA, is another big one that plays into permitting and notices of violation that sometimes our installations receive. And those are just the federal statutes. There are also many Army regulations and policy memos that provide additional guidance, in particular on TJAC's responsibilities with regard to environmental issues and litigation. These regulations also outline ELD's responsibilities in providing advice to the field and representing the Army in conjunction with the DOJ in ongoing litigation. And they also prescribe just the procedural requirements for complying with statutory obligations and reporting environmental issues as they arise.
So there are so many. The field is really broad with the number of federal and state like statutes and regulations and all those that affect our operations. So
that's right.
How does the Army even go about beginning to balance environmental protection with its own operational needs?
I think the way that you asked that question is almost the perfect way of providing the bluff in the answer to that. And I say that because the Army's environmental practice is all about that balance. Unless we've waived sovereign immunity regarding certain statutes, we, much like any other government agency or private party, are required to protect the environment and comply with relevant statutory and regulatory requirements. And if we fail to comply with the law, we get sued. And it's no exaggeration to say that injunctions, even temporary ones, adversely impact real-world training. And given that, it follows that environmental law is all about, it's more about than just simply complying with the law for the sake of compliance. It's about mission accomplishment and sustainability. When we understand, comply with, and we fulfill our obligations, it provides our commanders with the appropriate maneuver space, and I mean that quite literally, to ensure their units are fit to deploy and ensure our nation's security in the process. It's also about the health of our communities, to include ensuring every military family has, for example, safe drinking water and an infrastructure that supports their well-being so that our soldiers can focus on their duties without worrying about their family's safety. So to say in that sense that environmental law is the epitome of people first is not an understatement. It really does touch on every aspect of the Army's mission and our lives.
And ma'am, I guess that brings us to ELD and your role there. In light of that balancing, that constant balancing mission that the Army must do between environmental protection and operational needs and the mission of the Army and the DOD, how does the Army's Environmental Law Division play a role, and where does it fit into the Army?
We're, a lesser known division within the USALSA community, but that's where we reside. And we are, in essence, the Army's environmental law bar. We're a pretty small division, but we provide the subject matter experts and specialized training on a multitude of federal and state environmental laws, regulations, and policies that significantly impact the Army. We advise and support Army senior leadership and HQDA staff, and we also provide reachback support and advice to various other commands like U.S. Army Materiel Command, Installation Management Command, and Army Environmental Command, as well as, of course, continuing to advise installation and garrison commanders, staff, and attorneys throughout the country on their issues as they arise. But to summarize, our client, much like many other JAG Corps function areas, is the Army. Like I said, we're a relatively small division. We have two branches, the installation readiness branch, which focuses on compliance and enforcement, sort of the pre-litigation, if you will, phases, and litigation, where we focus on defensive cases and affirmative cost recovery cases. The attorneys that work within ELD are a combination of active duty military members and civilians, and we also receive periodic assistance from reservists. Our branches, as you can imagine, have relatively defined roles, but the synergy between the two of them is palpable. And our personnel from both branches routinely collaborate, work with each other on issues that straddle the two branches. And having served in both during my time in ELD, I can attest personally to the fact that it is a wonderful thing to see. And it is truly inspiring to see that teamwork that goes on between the two branches within our division. One thing to note and to emphasize, it may seem obvious, but I think it's an important point, is that we advise on, but we don't make policy, which is sometimes an important distinction we have to make for our clients. But just as in the rest of the JAG Corps, the final decisions about what policies at that higher Army level entail remain with commanders and those senior leaders. The legal viability of those new policies, that's just one aspect of our input, but it's a collective effort with many other stakeholders.
Really a vital division within the U.S. Army Legal Services Agency. And myself, being regular on your touch points with the installation attorneys, I was wondering, how does the division go about helping Army activities and installations comply with environmental laws and regulations?
That depends in part on which branch we're talking about. So I'll give you a sort of generic answer for how each branch does it and then some specific examples if that works. Within the installation readiness branch, the number of types of projects and the issues that we see there are varied. It's a little bit harder to predict those issues. And what I'll boil it down to is that the installation readiness branch helps installations to navigate the, be it fines that they receive through alleged deficiencies, to mitigate deficiencies from regulators to prevent future notices of violation. They help to review permits. They essentially exercise compliance to prevent litigation. The litigation branch is then when we pivot to defensive action, when we're sued, to enable the continuation of the mission as quickly and efficiently as possible. And it really often comes down to what those issues are at installations that happen to have significant environmental issues as to how those issues impact potential mission accomplishment. So, for example, some of the installations that we work with more regularly, just due to the nature of the issues at those particular locations, are now again Fort Bragg, Fort Irwin, Fort Bliss, and White Sands Missile Range, Fort Johnson, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and Fort Carson. And those are just a few. There are also a number of arsenals and depots that experience environmental issues on which we provide input and advice as well. And there are a number of ways in which we provide that assistance. I refer to some of them generally within the context of what the IR branch and the litigation branch do. But just as a more specific example, for instance, ELD is part of the teams that are doing programmatic planning for the stationing of new weapon systems, like the M10 Booker armored vehicle and the ECRA, the extended range cannon artillery, and the LRHW, the long range hypersonic weapon systems. We're also preparing documentation and legislation for the addition of about 22,000 acres of land at Yuma Proving Ground, which is needed for the testing of new generation aerial delivery systems. Another example, we're assisting with the modernization of Military Ocean Terminal at Sunny Point, which is the sole East Coast point for shipping munitions to European, African, and Indian Ocean areas of operation. And to return and emphasize again that this underlying importance of land, the Army, of all the DoD services, but is by far the largest landowner. We own a total of about 13 million acres. And that land management requires compliance with environmental regulations to include critical habitat considerations, since we're home to the highest density of threatened and endangered plants and animals of any federal lands. We have to put together integrated natural resources and cultural resources management plans to remain in compliance with the law. And of course, we talked about a little while ago permits for certain types of activities. And the bottom line is that fines for any sorts of violations of certain environmental statutes come out of the O&M budget, meaning those funds are then unavailable for other needs, which is why it's so important that we stay ahead of and reduce those to the greatest extent possible. Another huge area, like I mentioned when we talked about the Army's priorities generally, is water. That's been a big focus for the last few years, both in terms of asserting and maintaining water rights and ensuring water security, since that's so crucial for training and mission accomplishment. And the differences between applicable water rights law in the Eastern and Western states require the expertise of attorneys that are well-versed in these differences of the law and that can also identify the Army's current and future needs, which is where some of our litigation attorneys have really played a crucial role. And last but not least, energy and utility matters. That is an area that falls under ELD's umbrella right now as well, because we have a couple of what are called regulatory law attorneys. That is a little bit of a misnomer. Most people don't necessarily equate what they do with what that means. Essentially, they assist advising installations on utility matters and represent the Army, DoD, and other federal agencies' consumer interests in what are called rate commission proceedings to ensure that we maintain service quality of electricity and water resilience, and in the process of doing so, reduce O&M cost impacts. Just a couple of examples of where they've done that most recently include Alaska, where they successfully advocated in one of these rate commission proceedings for a cost avoidance of about $13 million. Fort Bliss, where they obtained a cost avoidance of about $700,000 annually. And there's also a pending settlement at Fort Cavazos that could save the Army about $19 million in O&M dollars over the next two decades. So those are pretty significant chunks of change there that can make a difference as far as what those dollars can otherwise be used for other mission requirements.
You know, ma'am, something that stuck out to me while you were describing the different branches, the mutually supporting branches of installation readiness and litigation, were just how much of an analogy it really is to everything else we do in the JAG Corps and probably the legal profession when you look at the worlds of military justice or contract and fiscal law or labor and employment law, of that we want to have good preventative law on the front end to help our commands. But of course, sometimes you have to go to court, and litigation is huge in that way. So having both those branches within ELD just sounds like it's so efficient and so powerful and impactful in our mission, and that mission that you described earlier. I just wanted to mention that. But you also mentioned some of the early stages of some of these environmental, hopefully success stories. Could you shed some light on some of the historical, what we might describe as Army environmental success stories that you've seen?
Of course. A couple of big ones that come to mind, and this might have a soft spot in those hearts of those that have been at Fort Bragg in the past, the red-cockaded woodpecker. That is a species that was endangered and threatened at Fort Bragg, and the recovery of that endangered species is largely attributable to the habitat preservation and population management by the Army. That's not something that typically I think most would think of when we think of just what the Army does. We have to use training areas. We have big vehicles. We have big formations. We take up a lot of space, and that isn't always a very clean, concise process. But we, through very deliberate efforts there, have been successful in not only protecting those birds from harm, but operating a captive breeding program that helps maintain genetic diversity of that species. And as a result, we have essentially brought them back into a much more healthy population than they were looking at for a while there, which is a great success story. In Hawaii, another great example is that the garrison operates and maintains a seed bank and nursery propagating native plants for transplanting on Army and other lands. And because of the Army's effort in this regard there, many threatened and endangered species exist on Army-owned and operated lands that otherwise might have also no longer existed, but for the Army's efforts. As a result, we are now able to continue to see the flourishing of those species. And then what I hope will be a future success story, but is still very much in the early phases of its development, is Kastner Range, which is still technically part of Fort Bliss in Texas. It's a former bombing range, so there's a lot of cleanup that still has to happen before we can get to what we hope will be the future environment of that area. But it is now a national monument under the Antiquities Act. And the hope is that it will eventually become an area for hiking and other recreational activities that will also preserve natural and cultural resources there. And that is a unique endeavor for the Army because we are the manager of that national monument, which is the first time that's happened in about 90 years. So although there's still a lot of work to be done out there, it is potentially a future success story that I hope we'll be able to talk about in, you know, maybe a few years from now.
And just in the next few months, ma'am, I will mention as a teaser to our listeners to this podcast, they might hear a little bit more about Castor Range in the next several months as we talk with some of your other colleagues there at Environmental Law Division about that. So thank you for mentioning it.
Of course.
So focusing now more on the litigation arm of ELD, and then knowing that the Department of Justice, you know, they typically take the role of trial attorney for Army litigation. How do you guys, and this is again your branch, how do you guys go about cooperating with the DOJ, you know, kind of on litigation? What does that look like? And for example, do you guys appear in court from time to time? Do you do depositions? Do you help in the motions practice? Do judges ever like ask you questions as the agency representative?
Yeah, of course. No problem. I would call it a very collaborative relationship, just sort of like the one between our two branches within ELD. Our roles are, for the most part, as follows. We provide expertise in developing the facts and researching legal issues and rules. We work with the DOJ on case strategy, on issue development, interpreting evidence and legal arguments. We also do help draft proceedings. We help the discovery with discovery responses and motions. And a lot of that also then requires us to preserve, identify, collect, and review and produce our own documents and exhibits to include issuing legal holds to litigation holds, I should say, to Army records managers. And that process in itself can be very time consuming, especially in those older World War II, Cold War era cases that I mentioned earlier, because some of those records are only in paper form. Thus, it's quite the endeavor to go and figure out which boxes we need to request, which documents will actually answer the mail and what we are attempting to provide. And again, that requires quite a bit of input from our attorneys and to work with DOJ on then translating what those documents mean. We also identify and prepare witnesses for declarations, depositions, and trial in conjunction with DOJ. And a big piece of it, like you alluded to, is that education, right? We educate DOJ counsel and often even judges on the Army, how we operate, how we do things, how business runs generally. And although DOJ counsel are usually first chairing the cases and the representatives of the government in the room, so to speak, there have been a few exceptions or cases in which ELD attorneys have sat as first chair. And so that's been pretty exciting to see. I haven't seen it myself during the short time that I've been the litigation branch chief, but never say never.
Ma'am, you've been talking about DOJ, but I think a lot of folks would not be surprised to hear that ELD would interface with other federal, state, and local agencies on all these environmental issues, especially in light of all of the different federal statutes you mentioned and the state ones that you alluded to as well. What does that look like for the interface between ELD and these other agencies out there? I mean, do you attend public meetings? Do you communicate with leaders from those local governments? What kind of things does ELD do with that?
I'll say it's a little bit of a lawyer answer in that it depends on the case, but we certainly do represent the Army before local, state, regional, and or federal agencies concerning all sorts of issues that arise under federal and state laws and regulations. And what it looks like, again, it somewhat depends. But for example, within the installation readiness branch, those attorneys work directly with installations and local and federal regulators to resolve alleged violations of those laws. And because we've waived sovereign immunity for Army installations with regard to certain environmental laws, including some for which the states have taken enforcement responsibilities, this really does put us and installation personnel in direct contact with those regulators when issues arise. That contact can consist of discussions with regard to negotiations to try to bring down those fine amounts by some extent. They might start to bridge over into what we're now looking at in one case with an administrative consent decree skipped over entirely the NOV process and went right to that sort of next phase of the process in New Mexico in a case that we're, again, handling at the moment between the two branches. So it does depend somewhat on what the issue is, but there is a lot of direct contact with those agencies and regulators. In some cases, yes, there is a cause for us, a reason for us to attend public meetings as well. Like in one case last fall, where there were public meetings regarding the disposition of the Confederate Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery. And although we didn't have a speaking role there, we attended and listened to the comments, and that was invaluable in informing then how we approached the next steps of the NEPA process there. And as another example, our regulatory law team that I mentioned a moment ago, they represent the Army and DOD directly at State Utility Commission hearings to ensure we secure the best rates possible for those essential utilities like electricity and water. So the interactions are varied and constant.
Thank you, ma'am.
So I really hope that our conversation today may spark some interest in our listeners. So Carl Farrell, this last question for you, and that is, what advice or pathways, you might say, would you give our active component and our reserve component judge advocates who'd really like to learn more and delve into Army environmental law?
Wonderful question. I love it. I love to end here. So I will note that it's not going to be possible for everyone with an interest in environmental law to, for example, necessarily pursue an LLM in the subject. If possible, that's wonderful. I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. That's why I ended up in ELD during my 3-year utilization tour. So I obtained an LLM in the area of this practice in lieu of attending CGSC. However, there are other avenues to educate yourself and become more knowledgeable generally about that statute soup I mentioned, to include taking classes offered by schools that do virtual degree programs. My former supervisor here at ELD was doing that while in that role, basically taking classes on his own time in order to obtain an LLM. And there are also companies that do excellent webinars on environmental law topics as well that can really just help to inform your knowledge, your background in how to speak this language that is a little bit acronym heavy and a little bit daunting when you are coming into it without much context for how these issues arise. I'd also say that working in an administrative law shop at large installations like some of the ones we've talked about that have significant environmental issues can really help broaden knowledge and understanding of the issues in the field, and certainly the policy considerations that we are looking at primarily at the HQDA level. And then last but not least, certainly serving at ELD at some point is absolutely key and critical. Our current division chief, as an example, she's been at ELD for 3 times. So once post-LLM and twice now as the division chief. And so it really is a place to which you can come back and continue to broaden your expertise. And it's something that I encourage everyone to do if they have the opportunity, because it's been eye-opening and such an incredible opportunity, one that I never would have imagined for myself, given where my own career trajectory was going at a certain point, but one which, again, I will take away so many excellent, wonderful memories and experiences from.
Thank you. And if I'm not mistaken, you do also have a couple of reserve component positions there for folks.
We do. That's right. Yeah. As I mentioned, we have that support from a couple of attorneys from the 13th LOD that come and do their AT time with us and do also some of their weekend a month work for ELD. And that's been incredibly helpful in just clearing the backlog that we've had with certain types of legal reviews that can be very time consuming and for which we really would love to have a whole other attorney position for, but we just don't have at the moment. And so the assistance they've provided in that regard has been incredible.
All right. Well, I've had a great time. And Carl Farrell, on behalf of the Administrative and Civil Law Department, Major Cranston and I thank you, as well as Colonel Rowley, Mr. Holycross, for allowing for this engaging and thought-provoking discussion.
Thank you so much for having me. And on behalf of all of ELD, thank you for highlighting what our incredible team does in this podcast.
To our listeners, we trust you will integrate the information in today's podcast into your own administrative law toolbox. Until next time, stay disciplined, stay informed, and stay tuned to Hold My Rec.
This episode of Hold My Reg is brought to you by the Administrative and Civil Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. The views presented in this episode are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Defense or its components, the Department of the Army, or the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Stay tuned for another episode of Hold My Reg.